So this is John Costa with Rob Watson, and we're on Spotlight on Art Conversation this week, and we're joined by a very special guest. I'm going to sit up straight, and we're going to talk to Sean Clark. Sean, thank you so much. I've been looking forward to getting you onto our conversation for a couple of weeks now, so it's good for you to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Excellent. Now, of course, we've caught you between one of your many China trips or trips down to London, doing all the things you do, which we'll tease out over the next conversation. But I mean, first of all, let's go back. I always ask people this when they do the Spotlight on Art conversation with us, is when do you first think you were doing anything that you were doing creatively, or someone gave you some positive feedback and you're like, oh, I could do this as a career?
Is it
a clear memory for you, or is it kind of more?
I think there are a few things. I think as a child, on the BBC Micro, which was a British computer made in the early 80s, I had one at school, access to one at school, and I used to use it for making sort of what I called at the time graphics. And I'd write computer programs to generate graphics. And they were quite simple programs, but I used to get some good feedback on that. And I decided quite early on that whatever I was going to do, I wanted graphics to be involved. So I guess that was my first sort of computer art. Didn't call it art, just called it graphics, computer art thing. And then probably a little bit later, after I'd done my computing degree at Loughborough, I became a researcher at Loughborough University, and I had access to, at the time, the latest and highest end computer terminals and computer screens. And that's when I really started playing around, creating images, writing programs to generate fractals and this, that, and the other. And that probably for me was the trigger. When I had the tools that I could use to create images that I liked the look of, that really got me into the idea that maybe part of my career might be related to art. Not just computers.
And do you ever see it? Was it ever something when you were doing, let's say, it was paper-based or, you know, in a book or on a long roll of paper or anything like that? Or is it very much that you remember suddenly this computer gave you the gateway into that subject, as opposed to you were drawing it and they just made it and you could make a digital version of the drawing that you were making?
Well, actually, I was thinking about it. I used to use graph paper, and I would like coming up with rules that I would follow and draw on the graph paper. So a classic one is you have an X and Y axis, and from 0 to 10, and you connect 10 to 1, and then 9 to 2, and then 8, and so on. And you end up with this curve made out of lines. And I used to do loads of those, different colours and everything.
So you were already thinking what the computer was allowing you to do before you realised the computer was coming down the road.
Certainly I had ideas in my head before I had access to a computer. Now, the first computers I used were not really graphical computers. I used the Commodore PET at school, and I had a little ZX80. And they had a screen, but there wasn't graphics in the sense that you could draw with them. You could put characters on the screen, and you could do some quite nice images with that. But it wasn't until I had access to the BBC computer I realised you could write a program that would draw on screen. And at the time, I didn't really print much out because the screens were better than the printers. The printers were so-called dot matrix printers. What you printed were, you know, just about usable for printing out a piece of code or something, a program or maybe a document. But you didn't want to print. Well, at the time, I didn't see it as a device for printing art, although lots of artists well before me were using similar devices to make art.
I just love that whole concept of, you've got this idea and you've got this thought process and you can put it down on paper and you're thinking in that way. And then a computer comes along that allows you to put it onto a screen and move it into that kind of environment. And then the printer can't keep up. So then you have to wait for the printer to keep up with that. And it's this kind of constant battle of not just one specific thing. It's like a combination of things meeting at this perfect intersection that allows things to come to life.
And there's also that interplay between what you want to do and what you can do. So what you can do sometimes leads to new discoveries and think, oh, actually, I may not be able to create what I wanted in my head, but I can create something that's interesting. I think I'll do some more work like that. And a lot of my career, my creative work, has been about an interplay between the technology and my ideas. And the two feed each other. It's not as if I have a crystal clear idea in my head of what I want to make. I do something and then I look at what I've done and I think, actually, I could explore this a bit further. The fact that it's only a simple printer means that maybe I should refocus my ideas. But actually, one thing you said about, I haven't really thought about this for a long time, about my early career is I very much felt with computer graphics that it wasn't just creating a world, it was discovering a world, particularly with things like fractals. So a fractal program is a very simple program, but ends up creating a very complicated looking image, very complex image. And the great thing about a fractal is this self-similarity. The deeper in you go, you see more fractals. So it never seems to end. And I always had this dream that one day I would discover something inside the fractal that no one else had ever seen. So I did feel that I wasn't just creating a world, I was discovering a world through computer graphics.
So it's interesting. We had a guest on our spotlight on heritage conversation called Paul Vernon, and he's got his own sort of collections of different items, and he's created something called the Vortex Museum, where he's kind of constantly challenging himself to find connections with things. And he spoke about dreams, funny enough, but his dream was Tom Baker, I think, coming to speak to him about Doctor Who, because he hadn't bought that annual in the charity shop that he should have done, and it got away. And it's really interesting because earlier in the year there was a exhibition here at LCB Depot called Computala. And it was about the early days of the internet and internet technology and stuff. And for the first time, I'd thought about Citizen's Eye, which I ran from 2008 to 2014, about how in 2009, you know, I started my Instagram and then my Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, as it was then, X, and accounts. And about how we use like the iPhone 3 and the Nokia N96 to start creating citizens journalism and community media. Well, of course, to you, the internet had already been a thing for how long?
Well, this is one of my classic stories. So I was using the internet before the web. So whilst I was still an undergraduate, so 1989, I had an email address and I was using something called FTP for getting files, and Gopher soon after, which was a precursor to the web. So then I was using it, but it was a very difficult thing to use because the UK wasn't directly on the internet. What you had to do was you had to go to a computer in London and then transfer from there to a computer in the States. This was all text-based, there was no graphics. And when you were in the States, you could search FTP sites, file transfer sites, and then you would download stuff and transfer it back. So the whole connection from the UK to the internet in America was 9.6 kilobits a second. And the whole UK academic world shared that connection, but it seemed to work. So I'd started using the internet very early, but it was clear when the web came along, and I had beta versions of the earliest web browsers and web servers, that this was going to be something really quite special because all that difficult stuff was made so easy. So I made my first website in 1993. And there were about 50 websites in the world, maybe 100. So it was very early. And my first website, there were two topics. One was virtual reality. So when people think virtual reality is new, they've got to remember it's been a long time coming. And the other topic was a band I was into called The Shaman. And The Shaman got to see my website and said, right, we want to get you involved in doing digital stuff for us. So I was very lucky in the sort of early to mid-90s that I got introduced to technology, but also content. I had access to great content from them. They were doing quite well, so people would look at it. And a lot of people now still mention, or when they talk to me, say, oh, you're the guy who did that website all those years ago. So for me, I began using that technology, using it in a way that might be familiar to now, websites and this, that, and the other, in the mid-90s. And so that is a whole story, and there's a whole sort of area of things to talk about what I was doing then. I left academia in 95 and I spent the first part of my sort of commercial career making websites for lots of well-known companies and so on. But then when we were working together, I decided that I really wanted to focus on what I called music, arts and community projects. And so the opportunity to do the Citizen's Eye app came along, and that fitted in very nicely. So it was new technology. So what, the iPhone came along in 2008. So we were I think it was probably 2008, maybe six, no, maybe eight. So we were looking at a very early app. And what appealed to me about the iPhone and the idea of an app is that it would put content right into people's pockets, quite literally. They wouldn't have to go and get the content. You could get the content delivered to them. And then with your materials, community news and so on, I felt that was a great sort of set of material to be feeding to people.
And we had a WordPress app that was able to then feed multiple RSS feeds that could then fit to the building blocks of the app. And I just remember it always used to freak people out when you used to say, like, we meet at a cafe every Tuesday for an hour. Citizen's Eye's got a website. We've got like a page in the Mercury or whatever. And also, if you want to download our iPhone app, and everyone's like, what? How did you afford an iPhone app? Well, we couldn't afford an iPhone app. It was literally, you just liked the fact of what we were doing at that particular time. Yeah. And it, again, I think from what you're describing with your own involvement in this sector, I guess, it's about timing, isn't it? It's the intersection of opportunities and identifying them and thinking, well, actually, by doing that, I could help not only us move forward from a community news perspective, but then it's something that when I look at your website now, where it's got all of your past projects, it's you always that kind of fail, test and adjust, constantly trying to think about, well, where's this going? Where's the technology going? Sort of future viewing, if you like.
Yeah, well, I think I've been quite lucky stroke analytical in my approach, in that I've always liked the idea of combining creative, let's call it creative, and technology. So I studied technology, but I had a strong creative interest. Now creative, if you like, is my primary thing, but I still know how to use the latest technology, AI and this, that and the other, and quite effectively. So I've always liked opportunities where you bring a piece of technology into a domain where maybe people haven't used it before. So Citizen's Eye, but also early in that, when I started to become interested in working as an artist, so we're looking at mid to late 90s now, I sort of had an opportunity to bring my technical skills into an environment where they hadn't got a lot of technical skills. So a lot of collaborations happened around about then. So I worked with people, musicians and artists and so on, in part learning from them, but they were also learning from me. So I facilitated a lot of collaboration. So I think all the good things I've done have been collaborations, actually, over the years.
Now, I want to pick up on that, Sean, because that's really interesting. This was my next question for you, actually, about collaborations, where some people turn around and go, well, I've worked in this sector all my life and other people have been able to use what I know or I've learned or what I've designed to help them. Whereas you're almost thinking about, well, I've got this technology and I'm able to use it. Who are my natural allies and who are my natural partners? And I think that mentioning that sort of intersection with your interest in music and the shaman and the fact that they came to you because you had a way of helping them to extend their music reach. We often think about how the internet killed the radio star, video killed the radio star, or the internet killed music, or, you know, all these kind of horror stories that you hear. Whereas in fact, you're in for this collaborative way of how can we help each other by collaborating with this technology? It's not the technology in itself.
Yeah, I normally have a fairly clear vision of where I think technology is going to be in 5 years' time, which at the moment is a very difficult thing to do because it's changing week by week. But I normally, my ideas are normally ahead of the technology. So I do get surprises in technology. Things come along that surprise me and cause me to rethink that. But I'm generally thinking what I want to be able to do. I want it to be simple. I'm always obsessed with things being as simple and invisible as possible. A technology, really great technology, is technology that disappears. I got that from a research paper I read 30 years ago. And they're right. Technology, you shouldn't have to be a technologist to make effective use of technology. It should be invisible. So I'm often thinking about applications of the technology, and then something comes along and I can make them happen. And often that's a case of working with people who've got content or ideas that complement where I want to get to. So throughout my career, it's been about imagining the future of technology, when opportunities come along, working with people to realise them, to experiment and explore.
Now, you've got a computer arts archive and you've got a space here, which hopefully in the future we'll come down and record a more in-depth podcast with you about. But I think what I liked about the computer arts archive, and you can explain it to us a little bit more for those that are, for the listening, is the fact that because of your early career in academia and your interest in this subject, you've always documented your journey. So actually starting the computer art archive wasn't, oh, someone's given me a collection, I can now create this. You're like, well, actually having an archive makes perfect sense for me to use my own stuff to then share and go and talk in China like you do and teach in China.
Yeah, so a few things about archiving. There's something I say to people a lot. I'm interested in archives not because I'm a nostalgia freak. We all love nostalgia. There are things we grew up with that only really us can fully appreciate. But I've always seen history as a really important way of motivating and exciting people about what they can do in the future. So for me, history is about the now and about helping us imagine the future. Because you learn so much from history. However, the history often that I'm interested in hasn't been documented. In art, let's say in art history, you talk about the mainstream canon, the canon of history, which is the accepted, written, documented, published story. But there are always stories that never make it. And so my interest in archiving is focusing on the untold. I call them undertold stories. Now, if you look into the history of computer art, there are so many undertold stories because most of these people were working on the fringe. They weren't part of a mainstream arts movement because they were inventing an art movement. So for me, all the stuff I've collected, borderline hoarder, I guess, maybe not borderline, over the years, I don't like throwing it away. So I keep it in my loft and this, that, and the other. But there's also me thinking, this was important. You know, even my early articles, I'm not saying I was a great writer, but I wrote a lot of stuff in the 90s and I've kept everything.
And they were of that time and what you were thinking at that time. Yeah. And that's why it's important, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think, well, actually, our stuff I did then, I'm still asking the same questions. It's just maybe I have a slightly clearer idea of what the answer might be, but I certainly haven't reached the end. But then if I look at historic computer art, I see people asking the same questions. And I think, well, if young artists or emerging artists could at least be aware of that stuff, the work they make will be so much better because they won't constantly be reinventing the wheel. So the archive for me is about capturing the untold stories, but inspiring people to look beyond the same old, same old.
So this is John Costa with Rob Watson on the Spotlight on Art conversation with Sean Clark. And I'm going to bring Rob in here as well, because I know, Rob, you were heavily involved in Citizen's Eye when we were running it from 2008 and 2014. And you'll remember the Citizen's Eye app and the conversations that we were having with people about cafes and printed media and that whole kind of conversation about the value of citizen's journalism and the mainstream media. Technologies played quite a role in what we do from a community media perspective. Do you think sometimes people get caught up on the kind of the physical item as opposed to, you know, what the technology could do and the way that it helps them?
That's a very good question, because it was never about the technology. It's kind of about what it enables people to do and empowers people to do. And I don't think we've progressed. So I'm going to say something many people might find controversial. Many of Elon Musk's ideas I don't agree with. However, the way that he runs X now is to push things down to the users to take responsibility for the content and to counter content on there. They've got mechanisms to do that rather than that being done for them. So that DIY, grassroots, decentered type of media engagement, you can have the technology and you can have the platforms, but you've also got to have, you know, what's the phrase? To be a leader, you've got to have followers. And do we have a population where people are creating and sharing their own content, meaningful content? And I'm not sure we've moved any further ahead. We're the kind of, you know, those early adopters on that innovation curve. That thing of Citizens at that point, it was really, really ahead of its time for many people. And it's like we're now starting to think of, well, how do we get people using these platforms responsibly, accountably, productively? You know, there's all sorts of many things rather than just doing it as they're told. That's the difference, isn't it? You know, that they've got a choice and an option to express themselves, make points for themselves, engage in conversations for themselves, but not doing that on the basis that they've imitated somebody else or have to conform to a culture within an organization, but can do it on the basis that it's an expression of what they want to argue and articulate.
That point is really important. I admire Elon Musk in lots of ways. I like people with a vision. And even if I don't agree with the vision, I do admire people. Although Elon Musk's vision, well, he's got lots of visions. He's an interesting guy and he's making stuff happen. Now, he's a big advocate of freedom of speech. And his idea of freedom of speech is a platform, X, where there are minimal controls on what's said, which sounds good. However, the platform still rewards people who shout loud, and he's the loudest shouter on the platform, and most of what he says you will end up seeing. So I sometimes think that there's a difference between the freedom to say anything and a system that amplifies the loudest voice so it's even louder. And I think one of the problems we have at the moment is that the things that amplify the voices, the algorithms, the advertisers and so on, they still amplify certain types of content at the expense of others. So Elon Musk advertising content and so on will always be the loudest, and then you'll get people imitating that. I think the challenge is, how do you get the quiet voices? I don't literally mean people who speak very quietly, but the voices that don't normally get picked up, and how do you amplify those so that you can hear a real authentic story from somebody like you that is not mediated by all of these channels and all these layers of loud voices? And I still think even within things like Twitter, which are notionally open systems, they still fundamentally amplify certain voices a lot more than others. And I think that's the challenge. The big challenge with social media and other forms of media is how to make sure that the ordinary people's lives and messages and stories get told in such a way they get picked up on and amplified. So what I would say with Citizen's Eye, and something you said as well, which is, all of this isn't about technology. I completely agree. Everything I do is not actually about technology. It's about an awareness that technology can help us communicate, tell stories, share art and so on. And I love technology. I won't deny that, but I'm not of the mindset that everything to do with technology is brilliant. I like certain technologies more than others. I like technologies that are invisible, that do things without you having to work hard at doing it, that empower people, allow them to say things, create things, in particular create things that maybe they couldn't do before. But if we could solve that problem of how do you actually amplify the quiet voices, I think we would make a really important leap forward. And I think Citizen's Eye worked out for its time how to amplify those voices. I think by being professional, by engaging with a whole variety of media, doing something we now call syndication of content, one piece of content in lots of different places, getting lots of people to look at it, you sort of, for that time, you managed to use all the channels available to you. What are the channels now? Well, we can't ignore social media. We can't ignore AI. So how do you make sure your content is in AI systems? We can't ignore mobile devices, of course. We can't ignore other devices, podcasting and things like that. So you have to work out how to amplify the voices with all the technology available to you.
So Sean, if you were able to go back and speak to that young man, Sean Clark, at school with that computer and stuff, what advice would you give him?
Probably a few things. Buy money.com when it was free. Get money. I could have registered money.com. It went for millions of pounds. Buy Bitcoin when it was like £2 a coin. That's what it was when I first looked at it. A few little things like that. And another, my little stories. Rather than buy that Apple Mac that cost £2,000, buy Apple shares and you'd be a millionaire. £2,000 of Apple shares back then would be £1 million now. So those silly things. So lots of things like that, which only hindsight will tell you about. I think a thing I'd probably done right is, and I tell this to people now, is I've always maintained broad interests. So yes, I'm interested in technology. Yes, I learned how to use the internet and write computer programs and all that sort of stuff. That gave me a career that I could earn a living through. But it didn't mean I should stop doing the stuff I really want to do, even though at the time it was actually cost me money to do. Make art was cost me money. I had to buy stuff. Because if you keep your broad interests, at some point you'll be able to merge them. There'll be a time where you can say, well, actually, computers and art aren't two separate things. I can merge them and they can become computer art. And that might be what I end up doing. So I would say keep those diverse interests.
So when you've got a group of, let's move that conversation slightly forward to today. When you've got this room full of people, lecture theatre, group of people in front of you, you know, universities here, or I said, mentioned earlier, you might go to China and teach over there or lecture. What is it about a particular young person when they're talking to you that stands out to you, that you think that they've got a Sean Clark view of the world? What is that? It's not necessarily owning something. It's not necessarily innovating or buying something or, you know, inventing something. What is it? What is it you think that a young person needs now in order to look at the next 30 years like you did when you were younger?
I think that thing about moving between disciplines is important, not to see yourself a thing. And when that thing is no longer around, AI's automated it. You think, well, what do I do? You know, I used to be a programmer, and now programmers don't have jobs because AIs can write computer
programs. So it's not thinking just because something's come along and replaced it or made it easier that you should stop doing that, and there's not any area to explore in there. Yeah.
Lots of things are, it sounds a bit snobby, but meta. There's a meta thing. So what is the real thing? So I'm doing this to solve a problem, and that this that I'm doing exists so I can solve the problem. Don't lose sight of what the problem you're trying to solve is and get obsessed with the way in which you're trying to solve it, if that makes sense. And so I've always had a bigger interest that wouldn't it be great if you could talk to your phone and it would just do stuff. And then that was a long time ago. I just thought technology should be so much more seamless. Well, that's always the big problem. The solutions are interesting, and tech comes along, which is a solution to a bigger problem. Keep an eye on those, learn about them, use them, but don't get obsessed just with the solution to the problem. Think of, never lose sight of the problem. But I think another thing is that in technology, a lot of complicated, difficult things, we end up discovering that a computer can solve them easily. Counting to a million, finding all the prime numbers less than a million. You think, well, you must be a genius if you can do that. Well, a computer, yeah, I can write a program in 2 minutes. Anyone can write a program in 2 minutes to do that. And the computer will deliver us the solution perfectly. But then you realize, so some of the really hard things are actually very easy. But then likewise, some of the really easy things are actually very hard. Talking to a computer, I think, well, sci-fi told us we would have that 50 years ago, or whatever, in the 60s, which is 50 years ago, more than that. Well, it actually turned out to be a really difficult problem. We now have it. But difficult problems are sometimes easy. Easy problems are sometimes hard. Be aware of that. Be aware that problems take different amounts of time to solve. But then diversity of interest. So this is the thing I say to young people. I tend to work with younger people here. So 8 to 14-year-olds. And then graduates over in China. But I tell them the same thing. You have to be diverse in your interests. Because you don't know, because it happened to me, if the job that you do when you finish, or in 5 years' time when you finish university or school or whatever, you could be doing a job that doesn't exist now. So you can't actually be trained for that job. I didn't go to university and learn how to be a web designer because it didn't exist when I went to university. I just happened to be quite lucky and I learned the skills very early on, which meant I had a little bit of a head start and became a web designer. So my first industrial job didn't exist when I went to university, but it was a highly technical job. And I think the same is now. I think all the jobs that people will do in the future don't exist. So how do you prepare yourself for that? Diverse interests, learn as much as you can about different things. Don't worry if they seem as if they're different topics, because one day they'll merge and you'll discover you've got a unique set of talents.
So Sean, for this final section, how do you approach acquiring something into the computer arts archive? Is it that's something that someone's done that you particularly like and you want it in? Is it a missing piece from your own timeline for your archive? Is it something you think that is the future, but we're not looking at it because it's quite old? How do you approach your acquisitions for the computer arts archive?
If I'm thinking of myself as a curator, and I have curated lots of exhibitions, lots of them here at LCB, but lots of locations around the world and so on, I'm the sort of curator who is always interested in uncovering stories, I call them narratives. So I'm always looking for an interesting narrative or something that might connect to another story in a surprising way. So most of the objects and artworks I collect, even when I get them, I'm thinking, where do they fit into this big story? And might they offer an insight into how maybe an untold story unfolded? So, for example, the Leicester story, which is one that I'm trying to tell, which is the Leicester digital art story. I knew bits. I was very lucky in that I've met a lot of the Leicester pioneers over the years. And one of them, Ernest Edmonds, was my PhD supervisor. I was very lucky to get Leicester pioneer. So I knew that Leicester had a digital art story going back to the late 60s. And I've identified a few key events and key people. So for that story, I know that there are gaps and I want to tell something that comes across as coherent. Now, I'm not saying that the story, this happened, then that happened, then that happened, then that happened, and then here we are now. I know that all stories are constructed. So I'm trying to construct an authentic story, but I want to make sure all the right bits are in there. So in the Leicester story, the Leicester narrative, I started at the beginning. I thought, well, actually, I need to look for things in this area. What was the bridge between this and that? And so I will uncover things and then collect them. Or sometimes things that are happening now, I think, well, I don't know how I'm going to use this, but it feels like it's really important. So I'm going to make sure I document it well in the archive. And then as I start to go my curatorial process, I put the stories together. And that's true across the archive. Drawing machines is something we're interested in. We've got some unique drawing machines downstairs in the archive by an artist, Jack Tate. Now, Jack Tate, he's still around, he's in his 90s, still making machines. We've got machines from the 1960s. And I don't think his story has been told well enough. So I'm collecting the stuff that's whatever, because I want to tell his story. And I will put together a story that is his story about him, but it brings in other things as well.
So let me just pick up on something you said there. You said Leicester pioneers. So let me ask it in a slightly different way. Are there pioneers in this sector area that we're talking about that are globally significant who hail from Leicester, who come from Leicester? So they're not Leicester pioneers as in the best that's here. They're actually pioneers in the sector that came from Leicester. That's the story you're trying to tell, isn't it?
Yeah. I sometimes get told that I over-focus on Leicester, you know, by national curators and so on. And my response to that is, well, there are two things. First of all, everything happens somewhere. So where it happens is part of the story.
So you're just trying to put a pin in the map.
It happened here. It didn't happen. That's part of it. But also Leicester genuinely has people, Stroud Cornock, Ernest Edmonds, Brian Reffin-Smith, Steve Scrivener, I can go on, who were doing work which is nationally relevant and internationally known. So I'm very lucky. I can do my situated history. History happens in a place, so that's always interesting to me. But I can talk about people who are already seen as nationally, internationally relevant. So that's why I've been very lucky to be based here in Leicester. I can tell those narratives, those stories from a local perspective.
What's the biggest challenge for you going forward? Just bring us in the next minute or so, just bring us over the finish line. What's the biggest challenge for you going forward? Is it keeping up with what's going on? Is it having enough time to tell the story so far? What is it?
A couple of really pragmatic stories. One is storing stuff, because I have a lot of stuff and I try to be selective in what I collect. I don't collect stuff that has no value for the archive, but even now I've got more stuff than space. So there's one that is a very boring problem. Anybody out there got any space, secure, dry space that I can store stuff in? That's one. And the time to tell stories. You're right about that. Well-researched stories, because I do want to research these properly. I'm not going to make things up. I want them to be found grounded in good research. Take time. And that means you either have to find good people who want to volunteer, or you have to find funds to pay people. So I think those two challenges are there. I've already got enough material in the archive to tell 10, 20 amazing stories, but I haven't got enough resource yet to tell them, get people to tell them. And then if I want to get more stuff, I need more space.
Brilliant. Sean, thank you for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you very much. That's been great.